Hi, I'm Marco Werman at The World. We've been asking listeners and readers for support as we cover one of the biggest stories of our time. Thank you for the many messages of gratitude and encouragement, and yes, financial support as well. There are many worthy places seeking your help during this pandemic. If you think independent and accurate journalism is part of the solution, now is a good time to show your support for The World. Right now, all contributions will be matched by an anonymous donor who believes in fair, free global reporting. That means your gift of $50 will provide $100 of support for The World's coverage. Our journalism has never been behind a paywall, but it does cost money to bring you these important stories, reported with nuance, context, and voices from the front lines of our interconnected world. We are asking for your support to make sure this essential reporting remains freely available, always, for everyone. We're grateful when you listen to public radio, and especially grateful for your support of The World's nonprofit journalism. And you have a unique opportunity right now to double the impact of your financial support. Please go to theworld.org/give and contribute today, while your gift will have twice the impact. Or follow the link right here in the episode notes. That's theworld.org/give. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. A race for a cure, scientists scramble for treatments for COVID-19. One idea, tap into the blood of recovered patients.
And if we can harness these antibodies, you might be able to use them as an immunotherapy and neutralize the virus.
We all know we need to wash our hands. A few countries are going much further, hosing people down with chlorine disinfectant in so-called spray tunnels.
This is actually very unacceptable behavior and should be stopped because in most countries it's illegal.
Also today, the virus is taking a huge toll on New York City restaurants and especially one neighborhood.
Chinatown is on life support and it's quickly slipping away.
And we check in with Australia's Great Barrier Reef, finding some bright spots in dark times. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. Soon, it'll be time to go back to work. Or will it? It all depends on the definition of soon, something countries all across the globe are grappling with. President Trump is expected to provide his thoughts on the matter later today. It's a balancing act that politicians everywhere are dealing with. Public health versus the economic costs of keeping people under some form of a lockdown. No easy answers. Ilana Gordon covers public health for The World and has been looking at all the considerations. So what is she hearing from the public health community about when we could safely return to work or at least get a bit closer to normalcy?
What I'm hearing is, Marco, that it's all about context. So these policies really depend on the specific community that you're talking about and where it is in the overall course of the outbreak. Around the world, we now know that over 2 million documented cases of this new coronavirus exist, but the pandemic is playing out differently depending on where you live. Some places are just at the beginning of this thing. Others, like China and Singapore, are coming off of their big peak. And then, of course, that was followed by Spain and Italy. And then there are places where there are even more uncertainties. Caroline Buckey pointed this out to me. She's Associate Director of Harvard Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics.
In many areas, we don't really know where we are with the epidemic because of the lack of testing. So I would say it's very variable geographically and in terms of timing.
How are researchers like Caroline Buckey assessing when and how to ease restrictions?
The predictions and policies that can help answer all of that depend on what you know. And for Caroline, one of the biggest things is testing. It's not just any kind of testing, but the kind that can tell you whether you've been infected, even if you've recovered already, or never showed symptoms to begin with. And then on top of that, what percentage of those people who might not be showing symptoms have been spreading it? So in the U.S., that kind of testing just is not out yet in full force. And the answer to that asymptomatic spread, how much of it is coming in that way, isn't known yet either. And for Dr. Buckey, this is the thing she so badly wants more clarity on.
The reason that this is so critical right now is because if there is a lot of asymptomatic carriage, it means we're much further along than we thought. And that's good news.
And if you think about that for policymakers, if you're much further along, that can give a clearer picture of when it's sensible to restart economies and go back to work in a way with lesser risks.
What about countries like Singapore? Singapore has gotten a lot of praise for its response to coronavirus, how they're easing restrictions.
Yeah, so places like Singapore and also South Korea, they've been very aggressive in their response. And that means when it comes to both testing and the actual tracing of infections. And this is really important in complementing that broader social distancing that people are doing everywhere. Because staying home and avoiding contact with others, it can lower infection rates artificially. But when those places then loosen those restrictions, what we're seeing is they risk having a resurgence in cases. And that is what's happening in those communities now. And I know that we've been talking, Marco, about communities in Asia. But if we look over to Europe, there are a lot of countries now that are looking at easing those restrictions, too. And just today, the director of the WHO's regional office in Europe, Dr. Hans-Henry Kluge, said there's no simple transition for European countries that are looking to do this.
Ultimately, the behavior of each of us will determine the behavior of the virus. This will take perseverance and patience. There is no fast track back to normal.
And he's actually releasing more specific guidance for European health leaders tomorrow. But the thing that he really stressed is that this is like a gradual transitioning and it's not going to be easy.
The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for the show. Thank you very much, Alana.
Thanks, Marco.
Bleach and disinfectant wipes are recommended to wipe down floors and surfaces we touch a lot. But are those things safe to disinfect people? In many countries, including China, India, and Kenya, officials have implemented disinfection tunnels. Those are Kenyans who've just gotten off a ferry going through disinfection tunnels, like a drive-through car wash, but for the human body. Shaheen Metar is an emeritus professor at Stellenbosch University in Cape Town, South Africa. She wrote about how this technique was widely used in Africa against the Ebola outbreak and the risks it poses.
During the Ebola outbreak, more than 80% of the healthcare workers and the people who had not got Ebola developed eye disease, skin disease, and most importantly, from this point of view of COVID-19, respiratory disease. Because the chlorine enters the respiratory tract and converts into hydrochloric acid, which then destroys the lining of the lungs and further down. So this is actually very unacceptable behavior and should be stopped because in most countries it's illegal. Mm-hmm. And if you probably remember, during the Second World War, the gas chambers had chlorine in them. So it definitely is not acceptable to be sprayed on humans.
You're in South Africa. It's the hardest hit country in all of Africa by coronavirus. You've been advising the government there on COVID-19. First of all, has the government in South Africa suggested using these disinfecting tunnels or spraying people down?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There is no way that we're going to be allowing such tunnels or anything similar to go because of the fact that it is detrimental to human health and it doesn't add at all to the containment of the virus. So the answer is no.
Shaheen, what are some of the issues that South Africa is dealing with right now around coronavirus?
Well, I know you mentioned the fact that we had the highest number of cases of coronavirus on the continent. We also have done a huge amount of testing. So the whole concept from the Minister of Health and definitely by the President was to decide to go for early lockdown. And this was the advice given to them by the Ministry Advisory Committee. So what this early lockdown did for us, which held us in very good stead, was we saw instead of seeing 170 cases a day, we came down to an average of about 60 to 80 cases a day. But it is early days yet. And we are at the beginning of the outbreak. So the idea was that, yes, we have a lot, but we do also test a lot.
I know there's been a lot of pressure on the South African government to ease restrictions. The economy there,
yes,
like everywhere, has been hit hard. South Africa, though, was already in a recession. Is a lift on lockdown restrictions there in the near future? And what would it take to get there?
Okay, so we were supposed to lift today, but the lockdown has been extended till the end of the month. It gives us another couple of weeks to get the community organized because it's really, really important that the community is on our side and everybody in South Africa believes that they're part of the cure. So we want to make sure that hand hygiene is and social distancing and universal masking is going to be in place before the lockdown is lifted, either whether it's partial or complete, we have no idea. Our main concern is that if it moves into the rural areas, because we have a vulnerable population living in overcrowded conditions and poverty, we really must make sure that we don't get the spread going very far out there.
you know very well as an expert that it's the coronavirus that determines when the economy can start to return to normal. What are you hearing about the situation on COVID-19 here in the United States? I mean, the Trump administration aiming to reopen the economy soon. How does it compare to what you're seeing in South Africa?
Do I really have to answer that?
If you don't want to, you don't have to. I'm just really curious to know what you're thinking.
No, I mean, I don't. I really must say that, you know, it was just handled in a very different way. I'm quite happy to turn around and say that, you know, I think that it could have been handled far better than it was for the people of the United States. It was hugely disappointing that, you know, rather than spending time trying to contain it, there was a lot of finger pointing going on. The thing which is, of course, it must be said that the WHO has nothing but supported. The United States itself has waited for things to happen, and we hear that we've now passed the peak and we've done this, but in fact, we haven't. If we look at your curve, it's very different to, I mean, to my mind, I haven't seen the peak of this curve yet. I haven't seen the flattening of the curve at all. And I think more testing could have been done. It's not about the availability of personal protective equipment. More testing could have been done and more structures could have been put in place that would have reduced the spread a bit more.
Shaheen Mettar in Cape Town, South Africa. She's the past chair of the Infection Control Africa Network and is now advising the South African government on COVID-19. Shaheen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Denmark moved quickly to shut down much of the country and slow the spread of COVID-19. That included closing schools. Now the Danish government is beginning to send kids back. Tom Carstensen reports from Copenhagen.
When I ask my first grader if she's happy to go back to school, the answer is a clear yes.
Yeah, fordi jeg har savnet mine venner, både at lege med mine venner og frikvartererne.
I miss school and I miss playing with my friends, she tells me. On Monday, the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, said elementary schools could reopen this week.
God eftermiddag og velkommen her til statsministeriet.
But school in the time of corona will be different. Classes will be divided into smaller groups. The same students will be together in class time and at recess. Much of the school day will be spent outdoors and dismissal will be early.
Mange af dine kunder,
Jens Hultqvist has a 7-year-old daughter and works as a school teacher.
It's under control or manageable in the process of being controlled.
Do you feel safe sending her back to school?
Yeah, by knowing that, putting my faith in that no child has been fallen victim to any diseases related to the virus.
Hultqvist says he's also comfortable getting back to teaching. He worries most about safety measures to keep the children away from each other.
We have to remember that they are children first and foremost, and then there will always be illness and sickness and viruses, but that has to come second to the child's personal development and the social skills and development of the cognitive facilities.
Danish kids above the age of 12 will not return to school just yet. All of their exams are cancelled for the year, but students will still receive grades for all the classwork they've done. Thomas Benfield is a scientist clinician and one of the key physicians in the fight against COVID-19 in Denmark. He's positive about the decision to start sending kids back to school.
We need to open up society in one way or the other. And choosing the smaller children, I think, is pretty wise because they're rarely ill from coronavirus. So everything looks pretty good, but we still have to be careful.
Kindergartens and nursery schools are also opening in Denmark, but with limited capacity. Many can only take in half or fewer of the children they once did because of the new rules on hygiene and distancing. Tina Splisbol lives in central Copenhagen. She's not sure if her daughter will be able to return to kindergarten just yet.
We got a five-page long letter the other day stating that they'll be only focused on hygiene and not so much the caretaking part. So I'm just afraid that if I go and handle over my daughter to one of the childminders, that sometimes she cries, but then often there's a warm lap she can sit on and be comforted. And what about now?
Are you worried about the actual disease?
that's actually the least of my worries, because my daughter is strong and healthy, I'm strong and healthy, but I'm of course very worried if she's going to pass it on to somebody else.
Some parents are worried about sending their kids back into the world during this time of pandemic, but others are happy about not having to continue with homeschooling. And that's a feeling my daughter shares with blatant honesty. My teachers are definitely better than you are, she says about my teaching skills. And then, upping the ante, she says being at home with mom and dad, instead of seeing her friends for a full month, is quite enough. It's been irritating, and sometimes quite boring, she says. For the world, I'm Tom Carstensen in Copenhagen.
We know you value what we do here at The World. Right now, during the outbreak of COVID-19, our global coverage is a critical source of information for listeners and readers. Today, we are asking you to support our freely available fact-based reporting. When you support The World, your donation will be doubled by an anonymous donor who, like you, values the important stories, global context, and critical voices we bring you every weekday from the front lines of our interconnected world. These days, more than ever, independent journalism is an important part of our democracy. We're asking you to help support it and have your donation matched. Go to theworld.org/give. And don't forget, your donation will be doubled by an anonymous supporter. If you have never contributed to The World before, now is the time to give. That's theworld.org/give. And thank you. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Australia's Great Barrier Reef, one of the natural wonders of the world, is experiencing its third major bleaching event in the last 5 years. New aerial surveys are showing that more than half of the reef system has lost its vibrant colors. Bleaching is caused partly by warming oceans and climate change and can eventually kill a coral reef. One Australian scientist is searching for bright spots in this dark news. That's what we're looking at in this week's Climate Solutions segment, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Josh Sinner is an environmental social scientist at James Cook University in Townsville, Australia, right next to the Great Barrier Reef. He says the coral reefs across the world are facing numerous threats.
Climate change is only one of the drivers of change on coral reefs. Even if we solved climate change tomorrow, many of the world's coral reefs would still be overfished and suffering from pollution. And so we need to be thinking about how we can build resilience in coral reefs themselves, but also in the coastal communities whose livelihoods depend on the beauty and bounty of coral reefs.
What attributes make some coral reefs fare better than others? And what can we learn from those reefs that might help sustain other reefs?
That actually speaks directly to a study I did a couple of years ago. We conducted over 6,000 reef surveys across 46 countries and looked for places that, for all intents and purposes, should have been degraded but weren't. And we called those our bright spots. Bright spots aren't necessarily pristine reefs, but they're rather reefs that are doing better than they should be, given the pressures that they face. The reefs that are kind of punching above their weight. We found that bright spots were associated with having high levels of dependence on fishing, and this seems kind of counterintuitive, but decades of research into common property institutions found that where people's livelihoods depend on resources, they're willing to develop and invest in creative solutions to environmental problems. We also found strong local traditions with the sea and high levels of participation in management by the local communities.
I would guess you spend a good amount of time in reefs. Remind us of the variety of colors we should see among living coral species and how that contrasts with reefs that are bleached out.
When you dive on an intact reef system, the colors are extraordinary. I mean, the color palettes some of these individual fish have, you know, they seem like a Picasso painting. There's this large mosaic of gorgeous textures with tons of fish swimming everywhere. Now, if you contrast that, typically degraded reefs get taken over by algae. Rather than this mosaic of colors and textures, you see a kind of brown or green algal mat. The structural complexity, which provides home to coral reef fish, that breaks down, so the texture of it becomes much flatter. One of the sadder things I've seen, and unfortunately that's a story that's being repeated throughout the world.
You have a new study out today in the journal Science looking at reef management in 41 different countries. What did you learn in that study about what works and what doesn't in terms of how people manage the health of coral?
Our study of nearly 1,800 tropical coral reefs identified the reefs that, quote unquote, have it all. They were like the Hollywood A-listers of the coral reef world. And in short, we wanted to find out how local management efforts, such as no-fishing marine reserves, could help reefs get on the A-list. I think there's two important results from our study. The first is that A-listers are rare, but geographically widespread. The second important result is location, location, location. So local management efforts can help coral reefs sustain multiple goals, but only if they're placed in the right location. We found that marine reserves can make the biggest difference in locations with low human pressure. However, local management doesn't make much of a difference where human pressure is most extreme. So I think these results are important to help determine how managers can maximize certain conservation goals and where they might be wasting their time.
I know that as you move forward, you're auditing all your previous work, looking for what you call exceptional responders. What does that mean?
We're taking a page from medicine. In oncology, there's a small minority of patients that have remarkable responses to drug therapy, and these are called the exceptional responders. Well, we're planning to do something analogous with coral reefs to find out which reefs are recovering remarkably, which are doing worse, and why.
3 weeks ago, one of your colleagues, Terry Hughes, tweeted that bearing witness to the coral bleaching, it made him feel like an art lover wandering through the Louvre as it burns to the ground. How does focusing on solutions help you cope personally as the metaphoric museum burns to the ground?
It's kind of in my veins. I've always been drawn to looking for solutions to hard environmental problems. But I also think that finding solutions is much more intellectually interesting than simply pointing out problems. As a social scientist, I think that many of the solutions to environmental problems are decidedly social in nature, and issues such as getting people to cooperate and act collectively are intellectually exciting and very challenging. That's kind of what keeps me going.
Josh Sinner is an environmental social scientist at James Cook University in Townsville, northeastern Australia. Josh, great to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Margo.
If you've been having trouble getting your daily 10,000 steps in lately, here's some inspiration. Captain Tom Moore, 99-year-old World War II veteran in Bedfordshire, England. Earlier this month, he set out to complete a goal, 100 laps of his back garden before his 100th birthday. This morning, using his walker and with an honor guard standing watch from a safe distance.
Inches to go, and there he is. Congratulations. Well done. Absolutely amazing, amazing achievement.
It was. This was not just purely for recreation, by the way. Moore was also raising money for Britain's National Health Service, the NHS. He wanted to give back for the care he received while recovering from skin cancer and a broken hip. He gave a shout out to the super good nurses.
Who were always so kind and patient. They deserve so much more than we can possibly give them. But maybe the best we can do is what we should do.
Moore's fundraiser started with a modest target, £1,000, about $1,200. He smashed that. As of this morning, Moore has raised more than $17 million. And I might add, well ahead of schedule, his 100th birthday is April 30th. His daughter, Hannah Ingram Moore, says at some point, a celebration is in order.
We were planning a big party with all the family, all our friends, a singer, a hog roast from the local butcher, a marquee, the works. Of course, we cannot do that, and respectfully, we cannot do that. So we will have a much more low-key party, and unfortunately, it's now up to me to make the cake, but we will do the very best that we can.
Nice work, Captain Tom. Hope at some point you get that big hog roast. You deserve it. News headlines are coming up. You're listening to The World. Inside the TikTok ministry, in Finland, social media influencers carry a lot of clout, so the Finnish government is working with them to get out the right information and answer questions like, can I still go skiing?
And I was basically delivering the message, don't come here anymore. It's not safe to travel in Finland right now.
Finns fighting fake news, that's ahead on The World. Scientists across the globe are racing to find a possible vaccine against the coronavirus. They're also racing to come up with treatments for people who have COVID-19. There's one research collaboration that's trying to harness the power of our own immune systems and come up with a treatment that would use the antibodies in the blood of recovered COVID-19 patients. Here's reporter Ari Daniel with our WGBH partner program, Nova.
It was early March in Toronto. Over the weekend, André Valteau went out for drinks with his friends. On Sunday, he spent the day at a work event. But by Monday morning, he felt exhausted.
And then on the Tuesday, I was starting to have a bit of itching at the back of my throat. And then I got a call from public health, just letting me know that I was in contact with someone who had tested positive.
Positive for SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus. Valteau immediately self-quarantined. His fatigue continued. He developed a persistent cough and a migraine. Do you remember, like, the lowest moment of when you were battling with this virus?
The most difficult part was actually, I wouldn't say the virus, it's more the isolation. In my case, I live alone, so it's not like I have people that I can talk to in person.
Valteau turned 27 during his quarantine. He celebrated alone, but his aunt and uncle and his friends dropped off 2 full cakes.
Yeah, they went all out. I still have cake in my fridge right now. It's a lot.
Gradually, Valteau made a full recovery. His thoughts then turned from his own care to something bigger. Whether there were any researchers in need of blood from people who'd successfully defeated COVID-19.
I really wanted to be able to play my part in this and just help in any way that I possibly could.
Valteau didn't have to go far. Just across town, at the University of Toronto, a research effort was underway. It's led by Mario Ostrowski, an infectious disease doctor.
After a person recovers from a COVID-19 infection, their immune system has already probably made enough antibodies to protect them from subsequent infections. And if we can harness these antibodies, you might be able to use them as an immunotherapy and neutralize the virus.
Doctors in China and the U.S. have transfused antibodies from recovered patients directly into the blood of people with severe cases of COVID-19. But Ostrowski is talking about something different, identifying the genes that encode these antibodies and using them to mass-produce lab-grown versions. Those would then be turned into a drug to treat the infection. Today, antibodies synthesized in the lab are used in Ebola and cancer treatments, and if Ostrowski has anything to say about it, they could help us win the fight against the coronavirus.
So André is here. Now we're just getting blood pressure being taken.
André Valteau is lying down in Ostrowski's research facility, where a nurse is scanning his arm for the right vein.
So I'll put it in here. So give me 1 second. Just bend your arm.
An intravenous tube draws blood from one arm, routes it into a machine with a tiny centrifuge that removes white blood cells and other immune cells, and then snakes the remaining blood back to the other arm.
It's a way of just extracting immune cells.
It's actually just a really quick pinch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, not that big.
No, but this is like if you're donating blood. It looks big,
but it's
very short.
It's like the one for the blood bank.
It's really not as
it's the same
as
one.
It looks. Okay, you ready?
It's just a sharp pinch.
Ouch.
Ouch.
That's
okay.
All right, André. Starting. So...
the procedure takes up to 2 hours, and at the end of it, Valteau will have contributed about 5 tablespoons of plasma and several billion immune cells.
Because there's so many, we can distribute them to labs all over the world, and they can do very extensive analyses on those samples.
One of those labs is in Nashville, Tennessee. It belongs to James Crow, who directs the Vanderbilt Vaccine Center.
Your body makes tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of antibodies to a virus, and typically they do work in concert. It's almost like a musical orchestra or ensemble.
Crow and his team sifted through several thousand antibodies isolated from the blood of four patients in Toronto, Seattle, and Madison, Wisconsin. It's like searching through an orchestra of thousands of instruments for the one playing just the right melody, one powerful enough that by itself, it could be made into a drug to treat COVID-19.
So that's what we really want, is just one or two antibodies that in and of themselves can do everything needed to prevent infection. And then it's game over for the virus.
The antibody he's after might block the coronavirus from docking to our cells in the first place. Or even if the virus does manage to attach, maybe the antibody prevents it from penetrating the cells and replicating.
We need the antibodies not just to bind to the virus, but they need to interrupt some part of that virus life cycle.
This approach is just one of roughly 200 efforts across the globe to develop drugs or vaccines to thwart SARS-CoV-2. Everything from the novel RNA vaccine that entered clinical trials last month to more traditional approaches involving, say, inactivated viral particles.
It's clear that we urgently need something. An antibody-based strategy could well be what is required.
Wendy Wobeser is an infectious disease specialist at Queen's University in Ontario, Canada. She's a colleague of Ostrowski's, but isn't involved in the antibody research.
Whether this will directly result in a therapeutic, I think it's a bit early for most people. I'd be cautiously optimistic that it will give some benefit. It's going to be a challenge to actually get it rolled out.
Only a small number of research efforts like this one actually clear all the hurdles to become an approved drug. But at Vanderbilt, Crow has already found a few promising antibodies, those key members of the orchestra, that his partners are currently preparing for clinical testing. He and his research team should know if one of these antibodies is safe in humans within 6 to 8 months, which is really fast. The people doing this work are moving at a breathtaking pace.
It's not even a choice. It's something that I have to do.
Mario Ostrowski again.
I feel this is a duty to society to use my talents to help solve this epidemic.
Solve it with a remedy that may be born in the blood coursing through our neighbors. For The World, I'm Ari Daniel.
We know China's central government likes to be in control, but how does that play out when it comes to independent scientific research? Beijing has introduced new policies that require Chinese scientists get official approval before they publish the results of their coronavirus research. To understand the upshot of that decision for the scientific community and the public, we turn to Yazhong Huang. He's a global health expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. Huang says Chinese government oversight of research is not new, but now officials are especially concerned with monitoring science that delves into the origins of the new coronavirus.
Well, I think we have to keep in mind that since the origin of the virus itself becomes a politically sensitive topic, the government that has strong incentives to control the research so that the research findings do not lead to results that are embarrassing to the government.
I mean, it's not unsurprising, but if this is a move by China's government to ensure top-down state-dominated control of the narrative, how the virus started and how it spread, isn't that risky?
Well, yeah, certainly. Control has been always there. This time it's been more explicit. When you have the scientific research you're subjected to control by those in power, it's then it then follow that logic of realpolitik that itself it's going to not just hinder the progress of scientific research, but also can make these government narratives become less credible.
Will the world be able to trust? Would you trust the science coming out of China if it's essentially been pre-approved by the government?
I believe that Chinese scientists are still doing great jobs. Their results, if they're peer-reviewed, should be trustworthy, just like the results, the scientific findings from scientists in other countries. It's just that on that particular issue, on the origin of the virus, when this is subject to the government vetting and censorship just to make their research findings less credible, less trustworthy.
As far as what's happening in China, what have you been hearing in Chinese WeChat groups about the public there and their trust in authorities at this point?
Compared to the initial stage of the outbreak, you know, in January, in February, I think the people's trust in the government has significantly increased. And that also beefed up the legitimacy of the government leaders. So that also was evidenced by all those conspiracy theories, you know, that become widely accepted, you know, that considering that the China is not as a region of the outbreak, you know. So indeed, people's trust in the government has increased significantly.
Are you hearing no cynicism or skepticism toward the government online?
Well, there's still some liberal-minded intellectuals that still taking a cynical, critical approach. But, you know, I think the majority of the population, I think their trust in the government, you know, because of this effective measures to contain the spread of the virus. You know, China now is becoming, in a way, one of the safest places in the world.
Yanzhong Huang, a global health expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. Great to have you with us today. Thank you.
My pleasure.
In Finland, social media influencers are critical actors for a society in crisis. During this viral outbreak, many Finns consider the work that influencers do to be as essential in some ways as a nurse or ambulance driver.
More and more people are trusting the social media influencers. So we kind of believe that the influencers are our friends. The bloggers or the YouTubers are our friends.
That's Ina Perjetilahti, the head of the Finnish social media company Ping. Her firm has been tapped by Finland's government to work alongside influencers to make sure that their coronavirus messaging is accurate. Finnish family lifestyle influencer Inari Fernandez is one of those influencers. She lives in Finnish Lapland. Her channel is called Aidin Puhinvuoro. Inari, did I pronounce the name of your channel correctly?
Yes.
What does it mean? How do you translate that?
It's like mother's turn to talk. Like, it's my turn to talk now.
Got it. And are you a mother?
Yes, I have 2 kids.
Okay, so your YouTube audience is well into 6 figures. That's pretty impressive. Your videos highlight scenic footage of the beauty of Finnish Lapland. You see families playing with reindeer calves and they're hanging venison out to dry in the fresh air. Your followers seem to come for the beauty, but they're also asking you about something pretty problematic, pretty menacing, and that's the coronavirus. What are they saying, and what are their questions for you?
Last week, for example, there was a fake news on Snapchat. So I got from a really young girl a message that, hey, is this true? And she sent me a screenshot from Snapchat where we're saying that this coronavirus situation is over in Finland and everybody can go out. I was saying, of course, that it's not true and don't deliver this message, because this is the most difficult part among the young people, that they are delivering those fake news as well. And they don't understand that if you see something that it's not true, it's not a good thing to share it.
Give me another example of a question that you were able to answer.
For example, I'm living in Lapland and this is like really popular tourist destination. So people were like asking if they still can come to Lapland to have a ski holiday or not. And I was basically delivering the message, don't come here anymore. Please stay at your homes. It's not safe to travel in Finland right now.
What if somebody were to say to you, well, I can ski alone, I could do that. What would you tell them?
I would tell that follow the rules, because the government is saying don't travel right now. And I think that it's really selfish idea that you say that I can ski alone or I can travel alone, because if you come here, you need to travel like 1,000 kilometers from Helsinki to here by car. You need to stop somewhere. You need to eat somewhere. You need to shop your food from somewhere. So it doesn't mean that you can stay alone in the car for the whole week. You need to eat something. The problem is also, like, we have small hospitals here in Lapland. So if there are coming lots of tourists here right now and they are getting sick here, there is no one to help them.
Inari, are you comfortable being essentially the government's messenger?
I really respect our government. Our prime minister is a very, very, very good leader. It's what I need to do as an influencer. And it's a really big honor to be part of this.
As I look at your channel, families seem to be kind of key. They're embracing the outdoors. They're embracing their time together. It can't be as easy as it looks, though. How are Finnish families holding up right now?
Of course, when the kids are at home, homeschooling, it's kind of difficult sometimes to do your own work. But now it's already like 1 month ago when it started. So I think we get to use to do it. I said already yesterday to my sister that I think this is the new normal now. I mean, I have 2 kids at home and they are asking all the time help from me. So I need to help them.
And do you have all the answers?
No, no, I don't have.
Yeah, well, none of us do, I think. Inari Fernandez runs the YouTube channel Aiden Puhinvuoro, or Mother's Turn to Talk. Inari, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's hard to believe it's been a month since restaurants in New York City closed because of the coronavirus outbreak. But in the weeks leading up to the mandated shutdown, one neighborhood was already suffering, Manhattan's Chinatown. Our next guest went there to document the impact.
I'm Grace Young. I'm known for my expertise on wok cooking, but today I would like to tell you what's happening to Manhattan's Chinatown because of the coronavirus. Chinatown is on life support, and it's quickly slipping away.
Grace Young is Chinese-American and lives in Manhattan. She's also an award-winning cookbook author. On a Sunday morning last month, Grace and videographer Dan An recorded interviews with business and restaurant owners. Some of them are now collected in a blog, Coronavirus, Chinatown Stories. Grace, thanks for being with us. Take us back to when you visited on that Sunday, 1 month ago. We heard you saying in that clip that Chinatown was already on life support. What were you seeing and feeling that day, and what happened later that same day?
Chinatown business had been suffering since about January, and I went to Chinatown that Sunday because I wanted to interview some of the restaurant owners and get a sense of what they were feeling, and was completely unprepared to discover that 70% of the restaurants had decided to close. I never dreamed that we would be recording one of the saddest days in Chinatown's history. By the time we finished recording the interviews that day, a couple of hours later, Mayor de Blasio shut all the restaurants in New York. So it was a very dramatic day to be recording what was happening.
I can only imagine. So one restaurant owner you met is Peter Lee. He's the owner of Hop Key. Where did things stand with his restaurant on the day you visited?
I had first met Peter 2 weeks earlier because I had written this essay for Food & Wine magazine about Chinatown, and he was really hopeful that essay would bring business back to the restaurant. So as I said, I was just sort of checking in on him, and he told me that this was going to be the last day the restaurant would be open. And Hop Key is a beloved institution in Chinatown. It's been open since 1968. It was started by his father. And it was very emotional and heartbreaking because most of his staff had been with him for years and years and years.
Most of my employees have been working for me for like 10, 15, 20 years. They're pretty much basically a family. But the situation leaves a lot of people with no choice but to close up.
Grace, how busy was Peter's restaurant before he closed, and does he have any plans to reopen at some point?
Business had been down, he said that day, 70%, but honestly, there were only 2 tables occupied in this restaurant when I arrived. And this is a restaurant that was always packed because it was one of Chinatown's most popular restaurants. When he told me that he was closing, he said he was hopeful that he would open up again, but he really didn't know.
The coronavirus, especially in a place like New York City, where things went from normal to desperate really quickly, I mean, the virus felt like a compressed time, and that's kind of reflected in your interviews. Like with Mei Chow, she's the chef and owner of Ose Peace. It's a Malaysian-French restaurant. Tell us about her restaurant and her concerns on March 15th.
When we arrived to do the interview with Mei, she was super upbeat. And business had been bad since January. It was down at least 50%, but she was not giving up at all. I asked her if she or her kitchen staff, and her staff is made up of housewives who are cooks. I asked them if they were scared, and her answer was sort of part feisty and part humorous.
Am I scared? No, I'm not scared. But my worker, I did ask them, are they scared? They say no also. So, hey, woman kitchen are strong.
Yes.
And we're not scared.
So we did this interview on a Sunday. By the end of the day, de Blasio had shut all the restaurants down. I checked in with her, and she said to me she had to close by Wednesday. And when I heard that, I realized that our interview was completely outdated and that we had to go back for a second interview.
I am definitely depressed, kind of. I definitely know this is not going to go quickly.
Yeah, a very realistic take. So May shifted to takeout operations for one day. That didn't work out, though. What happened?
Well, she tried it for one day, but the problem was she couldn't get her staff to return to work. They all desperately wanted the work, but they were afraid of hate crimes that they could encounter on the way to work.
The fear, their family are really worried about their safety. Like saying you go to work, you might not come back or something, you know, that harm. It's just, and maybe we think, oh, this is hysterical, but it's real for us in the Chinese community.
Yeah, it's not just a fear. The hate crimes are real. Grace, there's hope that in the coming weeks, months, things will slowly get back to normal. You've expressed concern that it might not. Will Chinatown ever get back to normal?
I don't think Chinatown as we know it will ever be the same again. And a lot of the businesses definitely won't survive.
Some suggestions have been made in your oral histories on Chinatown on how to help restaurants and their owners. And it actually applies everywhere. Buy a gift certificate that you can redeem later. Buy some of the restaurant's inventory. Are there any other things that people can do?
Well, for example, May started a GoFundMe for her employees. It's really a wonderful thing because they have no options. They need to put food on their table. So the Chinese restaurant workers are really faced with tremendous obstacles right now, and they are really the heart and soul of Chinatown.
James Beard Award-winning cookbook author Grace Young. Her blog is Coronavirus Chinatown Stories. Thank you for speaking with us, Grace, and thanks for doing these oral histories.
Thank you.
A tough battle for the heart and soul of Chinatown. Even little victories don't come easy these days, but they're still worth celebrating. A point that Korean-American musician Yeji celebrates in her new DIY track, Waking Up Down. Yeji's little victories are good for self-isolation, make home-cooked meals, stay on top of to-do lists, have empathy. Also good lessons when we're no longer in a crisis. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio, I'm Marco Werman. Top of my to-do list, joining all of you again tomorrow. We'll see you then.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.